started. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Sam. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRCPC call on the 3rd of April 2012. On the call today, we have Michaëlle Nayland, Hagar de Fowler, James Bloedel, Alain Béranger, Mikey O'Connor, Bob Mountain, Angie Graves, Matt Serlin, and Philip Corwin. From staff, we have Marika Koenigs, Glenda Saint-Géry, and myself, Nakuto Win. We have an apology from Paul Diaz. I would like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the IRCPC working group call for the 3rd of April, 2012. I apologize, I just took a drink of water and it went down the wrong tube. As you can see, our agenda is there on the right-hand side of your Adobe Connect screen. It was also circulated to the mailing list earlier today. Does anyone have any additions, comments, or objections to the agenda as it's been proposed? Mikey.
This isn't an objection, but Alain is unable to hear the room. I don't know. Natalie, can you push the audio? Maybe Alain is trying to listen through the Adobe Connect room. Not sure.
Mike, it is Marika. There's no audio in the Adobe Connect, so he will need to dial in through the conference bridge.
Okay. That's it.
Thank you, Mikey, and hopefully Alain can catch up with us here shortly. No other concerns or comments about the agenda, then the next housekeeping question is, does anyone have any updates or changes to their statements of interest? Pause for 10 seconds there. And I'm seeing no hands in the room, so we will continue. Thanks. We have a few items to cover today, and as you can see from the agenda, we're starting to move outside of the brainstorming session for Issue A, Charter Question A of the Change of Control, although there's going to still be plenty of work to be done on that topic. But I think that right now the sub-teams, especially Sub-Team A, will be doing a lot of the heavy lifting on that until they have a report back to the main working group. So this group will take an update then from each of the sub-teams. We'll start to take a look at the first draft of the initial report that Marika circulated on the mailing list this week, and I would emphasize that we're reviewing that draft for structure and not content. At this point, it is a very, very rough draft. We'll start to open up the discussions and deliberations on item B, which I believe is the time limit on FOAs, forms of authorization. And then we'll confirm next steps and move on to our next meeting. So kind of an aggressive work plan today, and we'll see if we need to add anything as we go along. But the first item of business is to review the get a progress report from the sub-team. Since Simonetta is not on the call yet, I'm wondering if Bob would, if we could pick on him a little bit and ask him to do an initial update, and then perhaps Simonetta can join in the interim, and if not, maybe one of the other folks on that team can give an update. So, Bob, would you mind going first?
No, I wouldn't mind at all. Thanks, James. This is Bob speaking. So, at this point, we do have a proposed final draft of the survey that Marika was kind enough to put together and wrap up yesterday. I'll send that out no later than end of day today to the entire working group. I would like everyone's comments, if at all possible, by the end of this week, by Friday. And also any contacts that you would like to include in the mailing list for this to go to, and with a reference to yourself to encourage a higher response rate. So once we have that by the end of the week, by Monday, April 9th, I'm proposing we send this out to the broader list, all of the survey recipients. So that list we'll be compiling. And that will set a deadline for responses on by Monday, April 16th. I was going to say the previous Friday and give everyone a week, but that, since that's Friday the 13th, perhaps we want to extend it until the following Monday. So that's the current status and proposed timelines. I'd open it up at this point to any comments, suggestions, questions that the work group might have.
Okay, Bob, thank you for the update, and I think it is wise to tack on that extra couple of days just because I think that the Easter holiday falls in there somewhere, and I know that some countries have extended breaks.
Good point. Yeah, that's true, too.
So some of them, I think that's a five-day holiday or a three-day weekend at minimum. So, okay, anyone have any questions or comments for Bob? I see Marika's hand up. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. I actually uploaded the survey in Adobe Connect room, so those that are interested can just already maybe scroll around and see a bit the structure of the survey. It's broken down into the two charter questions, B and C, and the different sub-questions related to that. And I've also posted the link to the draft survey in the Adobe Connect, and it was also included in the agenda. So for people already wanting to have a look, and Bob, I think we'll send out another reminder at the end of this call. As soon as you can send us your comments, if you have any, that would be much appreciated. So the sooner we can get this out as well to the broader community.
Okay, thanks, Marika, and thanks, Bob, and sub-team, data gathering sub-team for tackling this. So I think that if there's no more questions or comments, there would be Friday is the cutoff for revisions or edits to this survey with the goal of sending it out on Monday. McKelly.
Dumb question, but maybe I missed it. How do we submit edits to this?
This is Marika. You just send an email with your proposed changes. Because it's in a Zoomerang survey, so you can't directly edit the survey.
No, I know I can't. No, just what I meant is just on the main IRTPC mailing list, is it?
Yes, that's fine. Or I don't know if you're on the sub-team.
No, I'm not. Usually, that's why I was asking.
Yeah, then just send it to the IRTPC mailing list.
Right, Michele, I think at this point it's, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, but I think the sub-team is presenting this back to the working group as a whole for comments. So if you have a comment or a change, send that to the main mailing list.
Yeah, that's correct, James, yes.
Okay, so Friday is the date for this, for any last changes. And also, as Bob mentioned, folks, to submit any individuals they believe would benefit from sharing their expertise or their experiences. So I see Simonetta has joined us just in time. Good morning, Simonetta.
Good morning. I'm sorry for being late.
No problem. In fact, you're just in time to give the sub-team update for data. The ideal process sub-team relative to the change of control, and I know that we had a significant amount of progress on that, so go ahead and take it away.
Okay, so there's two things that we have done over the course of the past week. First, we set up a public mailing list to keep track of the conversations that sub-team is having while we're working on our piece of this process. And then we had a call to speak about more of these principles that we started discussing in Costa Rica, and we got down this list pretty far. I think there's only a couple, maybe two or three items left that we haven't had a chance to discuss yet to better define what these principles are, and if there was a discussion about one of these items to bring up the two or three versions that we want to bring back into this larger group so that you can give your input and that we potentially will ask for more input from the registrars or someone else on if we cannot come to a consensus ourselves. So we're almost done with this task. I think we will need another call that's scheduled for tomorrow to get through the rest of these items, and as soon as we're done with that, we'll share it with the larger group. And the second piece that we will start tackling tomorrow is to actually draft this initial version of a flow or process based on these principles that we can then also bring back in the larger group, hopefully by next week. So this is how far we got so far, and if anyone else in the sub-team would like to chime in and add something that I forgot to mention, then please go ahead.
Okay, Okay, thank you, Simonetta. Anyone else from either the sub-team or the general working group team have any questions or comments for Simonetta? Okay. Welcome, Barbara. I see that Barbara Knight has joined the call.
Thank you. My apologies for being late. I wasn't aware of the time changes kind of putting a, wrench into my calendar. So my apologies.
No problem. So, Simonetta, just for clarification, so we have another sub-team call tomorrow, and then we'll bring the principals back to this group for review during the next call a week from today on Tuesday. Is that your expectation?
Yes, we can either do that or we can share them up front after the call with the mailing list so people have a chance to read them before we have our call next week.
That's a great idea. You think it's possible that we could have them on the mailing list like, before the weekend starts perhaps, or is that a little pushing it a little too soon?
We'll hopefully get to that point.
Okay. Okay, thank you. So that's an update for the larger group from both of the sub-teams. And I think that, thanks to Bob and thanks to Simonetta and all the folks working on those that were on target for to be getting the deliverables for those sub-teams wrapped up, and then we can take a look at how that's going to continue to support our findings and recommendations. And speaking of findings and recommendations, the next item on our list is to review a very, very early, just being born sort of draft of the initial report. And if you recall, the initial report is something that we want to, if not have open for comment when we go to Prague, we want to possibly, at a minimum, be ready to circulate this in Prague so that it can be open for comment immediately after the meeting, so that when folks travel back home and get through their vacations and time off, that they have a chance to take a look at this, and we can present that at our sessions there. So once again, want to emphasize that we're taking a look at this section by section for structure, not for content. The content still needs to be filled in. There still are a number of items that are probably considered placeholders. But I would ask at this point, Marika, if you would have a moment to perhaps just take 5, maybe 7 minutes to walk us through the structure, which I imagine is very similar to the templates that we use for other working groups. And if anyone has any questions or comments, we'll just kind of let Marika go to the end, and then we'll take them all at once, okay?
Yeah, that's fine. This is Marika. So you see the draft report on the screen, and it's also posted in the Adobe Connect or in the on the wiki. I already got some comments from Angie that will incorporate in one of the next versions. But just to take you indeed through the structure and especially highlight some of the areas that I've highlighted in yellow that will still need completion as the working group moves forward. James already said, I think the structure overall looks, for especially those that were involved in the previous IRTP working groups, very familiar. Also, some of the content, if you look at some of the background sections, some of that has been, basically lifted from some of the previous reports, as, the background to this PDP is similar to some of the previous ones. So the first section is the executive summary. I've just put in here some information already on the background that, probably won't change much. But I left those sections that, still need further work open, and this will be completed at the end of the report once the rest of the content is done, so we can fill in the blanks here. Chapter 2 just talks about objectives and next steps. One thing highlighted here that the working group will need to decide is once this report goes out for public comment, how long the report will go out. I think the PDP requires a 30-day minimum. But if the report gets published just before the Prague meeting, the working group might want to consider extending that period to ensure that there's no conflict the time doesn't get too short as people traveling back and forth to the meeting itself. Section 3, very straightforward, that's really the process background and the issue background. Basically, I've excerpted the relevant parts from the issue report. to provide the context for those reading the report on, you know, what the issue is about and what information was provided to the working group at the start of the process. Then that moves into the approach taken by the working group, just providing an overview of who are the members. Once we've completed our meetings, this will also indicate how many meetings everyone has attended, provide links to the statements of interest, as well as the mailing list archives. I think there's one note here. Mikey probably needs to confirm when he exactly changed over from the business constituency to the ISP, so we can make sure that we have our records up to date here as well. And then Section 5, that's really where the meat of the report is going to be, which is the deliberations of the working group and you know, going into the proposed or draft recommendations that are likely to coming out of this work. So looking there, I'm actually noting that the numbering is off, so that's something I'll need to fix. But a first section basically highlighting some of the initial fact-finding and research, pointing to the training session we did with James, the case studies that the working group developed, to really, you know, make sure that people understand the kind of research that went into understanding the landscape and the issues the working group is looking at. And then it basically dives into the different charter questions. First of all, looking at, you know, how is the function currently achieved? Basically, there I've tried to capture the discussions we've had and the notes we've taken in the Adobe or in the mind maps. So again, there, if there's anything missing or any information incorrect, you know, feel free to submit your suggestions and comments. Then the next section for this charter question goes into, you know, comparison with the country code namespace and talking about the efforts the working group has undertaken to understand what is happening in the CCNSO landscape. I've included for now the annex we developed, you know, comparing the different CCTLD models and some of the comments in the report. If there are further changes to that, we can also change that. But again, really to provide a bit of the background that, you know, the working group has used in coming eventually to its conclusions. I think here you already see the first highlighted part where presumably at some point, you know, there will be some conclusions having looked at the comparison with the CCTLDs at which elements have been considered for inclusion in the change of control process for GTLD. So that's a section to be completed if the working group feels it wants to indeed highlight certain elements that it then had taken on board, you know, going further down, looking at the recommendations. Another section here specifically called out in the charter question is a review of the locking procedures as described in reasons for denial number 8 and 9. That's one of the areas we haven't really delved into. So again, you know, I've just spelled out what those denial reasons are. But again, here and highlighted, you know, the working group will need to develop its conclusions based on the review of those denial reasons and, you know, conjunction with any possible recommendations on a change of control procedure. And then there's a section which is basically a placeholder that would outline the proposed change of control process. I'm assuming that, you know, a lot of that will come from the sub-team that's currently working on this ideal process. And again, you know, this needs to be further developed and worked out. And then there's the section where the actual recommendation would be written down, where there's already a placeholder as well for indicating the level of consensus that was achieved for the recommendation, and also a reminder that the working group is also expected to discuss or highlight the expected impact of the proposed recommendation. A similar model is followed for the charter question B, also outlining the current situation. Here there's a little bit of a placeholder, as I'm expecting that some of the information on the current situation with regards to the use of FOAs will come back in as a result of the survey that Bob spoke about before. Because, for example, one of the questions in that survey is asking registrars and you know, other parties, you know, what practices they use at the moment. Are they limiting FOAs themselves? Are there no time limits being used? So maybe some of that information for this section will come from the survey. Then again, there's a section on data gathering where, you know, presumably more information will be added here once the survey has been completed. And presumably based on the results of the survey, the working group will be in a position to, you know, develop certain recommendations. I didn't write them out here. You know, my assessment is looking at the questions, I guess there are three options. there should be a time limit. No, there shouldn't be a time limit. We don't have an opinion at this point in time. I guess there are just a couple of options that could be explored here. And again, level of consent is an expected impact. Charters, question C goes into the same breakdown. What is the current situation? There's one question there highlighted that I think hopefully the registry stakeholder group, RAPS, will be able to confirm whether it should be at least or only. Then again, it goes into the section on data gathering, and also the further information is hopefully forthcoming as a result to the survey of the sub-team that we discussed before. And based on that, again, hopefully there will be proposed recommendations that then will be filled in the proposed recommendations section. So then there's a next chapter that talks about community input. So that's basically just an overview of the input the working group has received to date, one in response to the public comment forum that was held at the start of the working group, secondly as well as a result of the outreach that was done to the different SOs, ACs, and as a result of the outreach that was done to the stakeholder groups and constituencies and responses that were received as a result. There's also a link here to the public comment review tool, which has also been added, I think, in the annex, to show what the working group has done with the comments and how those were addressed. And then, basically, Section 7, presumably there we might want to regroup together the different recommendations throughout the report to gather them back here, but basically it's just to highlight that, further the refinement of this section will be done once the public comment period has closed and the working group has had time to review and then assess the comments and then make any changes deemed appropriate. And then there are just a couple of annexes. The charter is there, the template that we've used to request input, the public comment review tool, and then I already put a placeholder there at the end to provide an overview of the results of the data gathering survey. And I think that's in a nutshell the report to date.
Okay, thank you, Marika. Does anyone have any questions or comments for Marika on the structure of this report? I have a couple, so I'll put myself at the end of the queue, but just wanted to give everyone else the opportunity to weigh in. So, Minetta, go ahead.
Only one little comment in terms of the input we received. It would be great if we could also include a summary of the input we got from the CCTLD meeting in Costa Rica and the other things that people have said in the room there. I would just like to include that.
Agreed. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, it is, Enrica, because that is actually in the annex, because basically all the input that we got from the CCTLD meeting, I tried to incorporate that in the table that we discussed last week. And I think some people said that they wanted to add further information based on feedback they might get from their respective sales team. So, we can list out certain parts that are into the report, but it's currently in the annex. There is the detailed overview of each of the CCTLDs, the main characteristics. And there's definitely still room as well for the working group there to review the different models and provide further comments on what they think would be helpful or not helpful from a GTLD perspective.
Okay, thank you, Marika. Any other questions? I have two quick questions, Marika, and this is one is more of a it's not necessarily directed at staff, but more at the group. This structure seems to presume a couple of things that we really have not formally concluded, in my opinion. One is that there is a consensus on this group for a proposal to offer a proposal for a change of control process. I think that seems to be the general sentiment of the work. Certainly, we've kicked off a number of efforts in that area, and that the case studies presented by the earlier sub-team made a very compelling argument that the status quo is confusing and inconsistently applied. But I don't want to just kind of feel like we were backed into that conclusion. So I wanted to put out a couple of questions to the mailing group, probably in the form, not of a survey, but maybe just in the form of a dual poll, to capture that we are indeed agree that something is needed here, and what that something looks like, I think ultimately we're still working on that, but I wanted to put that out to the group. And then the second item was that there was a section, I believe, that's moved into Charter Question A regarding the reason for denial 8 and 9 and clarification of locking practices. Marika, can you... it looks like I have scrolling control, or maybe it's just on my screen. It looks like it's on page 7 of the structured report, and that section, I think, may be lacking in our deliberations right now of Charter Question A, so I think that we need to flag that when we have the ideal process change of control subteam come back and present their process, that maybe that's the time either for that subteam or a new subteam or this working group as a whole to address that question. But I think we might have missed that one, unless someone can correct me and show me that we haven't. Go ahead, Marika.
That is, Marika. It is highlighted in the mind map, but I think we indeed haven't really discussed it concretely yet. So it is noted there, but I think we didn't get to that yet, or maybe it's indeed something people are waiting for to discuss in light of whatever comes out of the sub-team discussion.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, that was all I had for questions. I see Simonetta has a new hand, so go ahead, Simonetta.
Well, on that particular one, does that mean that we need to make space in our work plan for this? And if so, where should this go? And now,
good question.
Is this something that the whole work group needs to make space on the entire work group's work plan, or is this something that the work group feels the sub-team should also be discussing? And then I would like to hear that from this group rather than just assuming that this is what we should also be working on.
Any thoughts on that, on the minute's question? Anyone? Very silent crowd today. So, Netta, I think that we should add it to that that group. If we don't have a moment to do it into this first round, that perhaps it can be done in parallel while the concept is presented to the entire working group. But I agree that it seems like it was overlooked. When I say overlooked, I mean by me. Okay, any other thoughts here? On this, I see Elaine has posted something in the chat here.
Well, it's just a detail. It's just a typo.
Oh, okay. I see. Thank you.
Marika has noted it. There was a typo in the questionnaire.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. And I think that with this skeleton here, we can start to put some flesh and bones onto this report, and it will start to take shape as we get closer to our publication date, which will be at or before Prague. But there's no more comments on the draft report. We can move on to item number 6, which is just a starting to open the discussion on Charter Question B. And, Marika, I don't know if we have some clean text somewhere of the question for Charter Question B, so we can take a look at that in detail. But I think some of the first questions are relative to our approach. And perhaps we can also dust off one of Mikey's approach mind maps if we have anything handy like that.
I've just posted the charter question B in the note pole on the right, and Mikey, I've upgraded you as a presenter. I don't know if you have any, if it's possible for you to bring up the mind map in relation to this issue.
Bear with me for just a couple of minutes. I wasn't I wasn't ready. I'll be back.
Sorry to put you on the spot, Mikey. I'll buy as much time as you need. How's that?
That's perfect.
So there's charter question B, and it states whether or not provisions on time-limiting form of authorization, FOA, should be implemented to avoid fraudulent transfers out. For example, the gaining registrar sends and receives an FOA back from a transfer contact. But the name is locked. The registrar may hold the FOA pending adjustments to the domain name status, during which time the registrant or other information may have changed. I think that last phrase is interesting because it kind of doesn't really even talk about time limiting necessarily. It just talks about, you know, what sort of a change in the WHOIS information cancels the FOA. That's one, you know, one interesting thing I think that's not necessarily a part of the time limiting issue. So while Mikey looks up his approach or his mind map here, wanted to just take a cue on any questions or concerns that folks have about whether or not we should break down this particular charter question into component tasks. And I think that while the data gathering subteam is definitely looking at some elements of this issue, want to be sure that folks believe that we have a work plan in place to capture capture everything we need here. So Mikey's got the work plan mind map up, or I'm sorry, the approach mind map up, but see that one person's in the queue, so we'll go ahead and go to summon that up. Go ahead.
I just had a thought on this one recently that I know, for example, from the .de registry, and I believe the .be registry copied the same thing. They went about this time-limiting issue in some other form because there seem to be two mechanisms how you can kind of provide a time limit in this transfer process. And one of them is the FOA itself, where you can say, okay, the FOA is only valid for X amount of time, but the other mechanism that is available for providing some kind of a time limit safeguard is off-codes. And so what these registries have been doing is they didn't look at the FOA per se to time limit that, but what they did is they issue off-codes basically on the fly while someone is attempting to do a transfer, and that off-code is only valid for a certain limit of time. So they have built a safeguard in that way, and it isn't the FOA piece that is time limited there. It is how long they keep their off-code valid. So I just wanted to throw this out as it's another option to also think about this. And when we think about the security piece, this is something else that we can also keep in mind as a tool.
Thanks, Ivanetta. And I think that's an interesting different way of looking at this issue. And I think it kind of substantiates the idea that it's the auth code that provides the security for a domain name transfer and not the FOA, which makes sense because one of those two things can actually block a transfer while another one is after the fact. You know, it's more of an audit trail, if I'm even stating that correctly. But one thought on that was that GTLDs, and perhaps we can look to Barbara and to our other friends from the registries on this, is that the auth-info codes, in some cases, registrars for GTLDs will set the auth-info code once when the domain name is created, and it will be unchanged. So in our case, it wouldn't be that the auth-info code would be valid for a finite period of time. It's just certain events or certain time frames would trigger a reset or generation of a new auth-info code. But that's probably a technical discussion that we could probably have at a later time. But I see Barbara is probably going to shed some light on this now. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi, this is Barbara. So basically, you're correct. So registrars can go ahead and set the auth info code when they create the domain name in the system. That is sent to the registry so that when we do receive a transfer request, then we can validate against that. I believe that the only time that they are modified, the registry does not modify them. So I believe that the only time that they would be modified is if a registrant, for instance, wanted to have their auth info code reset. And then, again, of course, the registrar would then pass it to the registry as well so that they would be in sync should a transfer request come through. Hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, it is, I think. I'm not sure that registrars, or at least all registrars, consistently implement the service where a registrant can request a new auth info code or request their current auth info code be reset. That's something interesting we should think about. Simonetta, you wanted to follow up there?
I'm wondering if we can, first of all, it seems to be the case that you're saying that a registrar generally has the ability to send an EPP call into the registry to say, hey, reset the auth code to something else. So whether or not this is triggered by a customer using a button in an interface or by just the registrar periodically, for example, when the WHOIS changes to also send a new command and to say, hey, change the auth code to something else at this point as well, because maybe it's not the same registrant anymore. I don't know. Maybe we can also think about some recommendations to give to registrars of when to update auth codes on domain names to provide more security for registrants.
I agree. Okay, so now that's an interesting point. I think something we definitely need to take into account as we discuss this issue is that where is the mechanism for control the mechanism for implementing security in transfers? And I think that the practices from DE and VE indicate that it is really an emphasis on the auth info code as opposed to the FOA. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the FOA is has no role to play here at all. I think especially in the case where, for example, an FOA is held beyond the expiry date of the domain name, or perhaps the FOA is, as we indicated in our charter question, the registrant information changes between the time that the FOA is obtained versus the transfer. So these are things I think that are worth considering as well. I see a queue opening up here, but I wanted to ask Simonetta if that is an old hand that just went down. Okay, thank you. So, Barbara.
Hi, this is Barbara. Thank you, Jane. From our perspective as a registry operator and the first level dispute resolution provider, we do look at the FOAs to the extent a dispute is raised and submitted to us. So from that perspective, we're going to look to make sure that the information on that FOA and specifically the email address of the registrant or the admin contact is consistent with the WHOIS at the time that the transfer was initiated. So the timeliness of the FOA is pretty critical if a dispute were to arise.
Thank you. And have you ever reversed a transfer to your memory, reversed a transfer based on an FOA that just didn't line up with, either was too old or had stale registrant information or something like that? Can you think of a time where that's posed a problem?
We have definitely reversed transfers in the instance where an FOA, the date on the FOA is not consistent with the data that was in the WHOIS at the time that the transfer occurred. So, yes, and whether or not it was due specifically to an old FOA, you know, I can't really say, but I do know that that is, you know, an authoritative record when evaluating a dispute, that and the WHOIS record at the time of the transfer.
Thank you, Barbara. Good information.
Yeah, and because we don't actually maintain the I'm sorry if I could just add on to it.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Because we don't maintain copies of the FOAs here at the registry, those, you know, go into the registrar and they're just asked to provide those to either the other registrar under the transfer dispute policy or to the registry in the case that a transfer dispute has come up. you know, we really are dependent on looking at those. And I don't know that there's necessarily a date that the FOA was created. I'd have to go back and look at it, but I don't recall whether or not there's an actual date to know specifically how stale the FOA data is.
All right, thank you. Samantha?
I'm trying to understand, and if I want to ask Barbara a few more questions, I guess. So it seems to me that the role the FOA plays in the dispute is that you want to have some kind of a data point to say, hey, this person may have given their consent to a transfer, yes or no. And it isn't necessarily this person gave the consent at XYZ point in time, but you want to make sure that the recipient of this FOA, aka the email address on it, is consistent with the WHOIS record. And so basically to make a match between, yes, this registrant actually gave their consent versus, no, it looks like somebody else may have filled out this form. And then if it is mismatched and you get a dispute, this would be an indication for you to say, hey, this domain should actually probably be, or this transfer should probably be reverted, which seems to me that it doesn't, I don't understand why it would need to be time limited for you to achieve that same thing. Maybe you can talk to this a little more. I mean, I understand that maybe your line of reasoning would be to say, okay, if somebody gave their consent a year ago, maybe they didn't mean it at this point anymore, but I would otherwise not understand why an FOA that was given 6 months ago would not provide the same data as the FOA that was issued yesterday. And then to spin it a little further, if it was time limited, you could actually start gaming this too. You could say, okay, let me log in and change to WHOIS record first and then wait 10 days and then fill out an FOA, and now the FOA actually goes to someone who has the same email address as is on the WHOIS, and you would have a match and you would have lost that data point. So I think I'm not sure if this timing thing really provides more security versus this other idea that other registries have been using with, like, keeping off-calls time-limited. Maybe you can talk to this some more, and if something comes to your mind why this would be more secure, I'd like to hear why.
But may I go ahead and address it?
Yes, Barbara, please.
Okay, so from our perspective, we don't look at the date. And I was back just trying to get to the ICANN website, to the consensus policies, where I can take a look at the FOA itself to see if there's a date on them. Because at the registry, we don't specifically look at the date of an FOA if it does exist. We just simply look at the data on the FOA, which is, you know, specifically whether or not the email address matches the information that's in the WHOIS, again, at the time of the time of the transfer request that comes to the registry. So from that perspective, we're really not looking at it. But the use case, if you will, or the instance where I could see where it could be an issue is if the FOA is older, and so it's been out there for even, you know, 2 months, and the registrar perhaps, I don't know, the domain name is locked, and so it takes a while to perhaps unlock the domain name for whatever reason, even though we know that it should be unlocked timely. And in the meantime, the registrant details may have changed. So in the instance where a dispute would arise, you know, the FOA that we have has one email address and registrant data, and then at the time of the transfer actually being initiated, has another. If a dispute were to arise, we would go ahead based on the fact that there's a mismatch between the two. We would basically rule in favor of the filing registrar saying that the domain name should go back. So from that perspective, you're going to have an inconsistency. It could very well be that in the meantime, the registrant that had originally completed the FOA and had that and sent through the transfer command through their what they wanted to be their new registrar, maybe has sold their name on a secondary market or what have you, and the new registrant details would be correct, but unfortunately, that information is not being supported by the FOA that is being provided in the case of a transfer dispute. Does that make sense?
Can I respond?
Yeah, please.
It does make sense, but it seems to almost point to the fact that in the use case that you just described, that FOA should have been invalid because a change in the HOIS has happened, and we actually have a new registrant. So the other registrant's FOA should no longer be valid. So one thing that I take from what you just described is that one recommendation could be to say that the moment a registrant changes over and you have an FOA on file, you should go ahead and actually ask for a new one because it is no longer valid. However, if nothing changes, I don't see why keeping an FOA on file for a long period of time wouldn't actually start making things more secure, because you have something on file that says, okay, you have an WHOIS record and you have a matching FOA. And if something goes wrong and a transfer happens without a new FOA being there, then you have this ability to say, hey, there wasn't a match, and therefore it is a data point to say it should actually be reverted back to that other registrant because they didn't authorize it. So I'm not even sure if this shortening thing or even the recommendation to always update it is really providing more security in those two cases.
Okay. Thanks, Simonetta and Barbara, for some of that information. I am following that as much as possible, and I think it's useful. I put myself in the queue just to comment from a registrar perspective. I think that there's an important concept here, which is that the security linchpin of all the security of a domain name should be the auth info code, in addition to whatever registrar services, registrar locking services are available. But the FOA is an important component of the transfer, and I think that it's I'm thinking of potential gaming or even some shady practices that could arise in either case. For example, if it's determined that FOAs are valid indefinitely, and that's something that we kind of emphasize as part of this working group, and it's not too difficult to see, for example, a shady registrar obtaining an FOA for a transfer the moment the domain name is transferred in or created, and then just keeping that on file just in case, which might sort of get away from the intentions of what the FOA is meant to achieve. I think another question that I had was relative to, there's a section in the consensus policy that says something to the effect of providing auth info codes, and it says something to the effect of if the registry and the registrar use EPP as their provisioning system. So my takeaway on that was, does that mean that the use of EPP and auth info codes is optional? And if so, does that mean that we can make recommendations specific to the auth info code that will apply universally to all registrars and all registries? And I don't know that that's, I mean, I know that that's kind of how the world works and that's how everyone has implemented their registries, but I don't know that it's required in the policy. So it's just something to put out there and think about. But I see that I have a couple of more commenters here. So looks like we'll go with Barbara, Simonetta, McKelly, and then we'll probably saw it off for there and wrap up the call. So go ahead, Barbara.
Thank you, James. This is Barbara. I think the reason it was written that way is up until a few years ago, VeriSign and perhaps other registries had not yet converted to EPP. So once you are an EPP registry, then the expectation is that you would have, and the requirement would be that you would have auth info codes that would be part of the transfer process. So if, for instance, a registrar would send a transfer command to the registry without an auth info code, then that that transfer command is going to fail, and the registry would return an error message. The same is true as if an auth info code is sent to the registry that's not consistent with the one that's in the registry system. So if the auth info code is changed at the registrar level, that is not passed to the registry at the time that it's changed, then if the old new auth info code were passed with a transfer command that did not match what was in the registry records, then again, an error message would be sent back. But I think, you know, what you were seeing in the way that's worded is just from an historical perspective that not all registries were EPP. There were still some operating with the RRP protocol.
Okay, so it's just an artifact of previous policies.
Exactly. But, I mean, you know, it is safe to say that any registry that is currently operating with EPP, they're going to require an auth info code with a transfer command. And if it doesn't exist or if it doesn't match, that transfer request will fail.
Got it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For clarifying. Did you have something else, Barbara, or just to respond to my question?
No, that was actually it. So it was kind of good that you asked that question because it was consistent with what I wanted to chat about anyway.
Okay. Thank you. Simonetta, go ahead.
I have a question first, and that is, when we're thinking about the new GTL days, does anyone know whether or not they have a requirement to be using EPP and auth codes? And if so, if this is a requirement for days, and we're talking about a GTLD policy here, is there a non-GTLD that at this point is not using EPP and auth codes, and or could we then just recommend that this could be a mechanism to provide more safeguards is one idea or thought. And the other idea and thought I had on this whole discussion right now is, again, the simple versus complicated thought that came up at the CCTLD meeting. And also I'm thinking about what we did with IRTP Part B, where we created a mechanism for people to actually escalate and say, hey, my domain got hijacked and here's what you need to look at, because I think regardless of whichever system we're recommending here to be put in place as a safe way to do business, there's always going to be people that are finding some way to game it, and should what we're creating here make it more complicated for absolutely everyone else, and the feedback that we got from the room in Costa Rica was, no, go with the simple fact. We didn't see increased levels in fraud or other activity, but we saw significant increases in satisfaction of the customers that work with us, a.k.a. the registrars and everyone else. And I think it was Leslie from the .co.uk registry that said, I hope that you will design something that will be easy to use for the users. So that's another thing that comes to my mind when I look at this whole discussion. We should keep in mind ease of use for the registrants who aren't professionals in this field. And thinking back to our original use cases, anything that we recommend should be something that's easy to do for them, because if it's not, then we kind of failed that mission to make it a standard and easy and nice process to use for these guys.
Thank you, Simonetta, and I agree. Go ahead, Michele. You're the last speaker for today.
Oh, dear. Hold on a second. I have to come back with something intelligent, which I can't really manage. Now, a couple of things. The reference to EPP, Barbara covered that. I mean, it confirms what I suspected, that the language predates the technology in some respects. Simonetta, there's a lot of CCTLDs that aren't using EPP. A lot. I mean, there's the number that aren't using some form of automated API type system is reducing all the time, but there's a very large number of them not using EPP. Choose.ie is a prime as an example if you want. They have an API, but it's not EPP. But I would be very, very wary of encouraging anybody to implement transfer policies or change of holder processes based on some of these smaller CCTLDs. Thanks.
Thank you, Michele. And with that comment, we'll kind of wrap up our discussion on this for today. I have some action items that I wanted to go over here in the last 2 minutes of the call. First off, please comment on the data gathering sub-team survey, which will be posted to the list. Comments for that end Friday, and the survey will be posted Monday. The ideal process team is meeting tomorrow, and we'll present back to this group next week, so we'll make sure we get that on the agenda for our call on the 10th. And I need to send out just a kind of a real lightweight poll just to test some of our consensuses that we've concluded to date, or some of our findings to date, and whether or not we're still standing on solid ground with some of these areas. So with that, I would thank everyone for their time. Our next call is this time next week, same time, same channel. And thanks for giving us your time today.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, James.
Thanks.
Thank you, Sam. You are now stopped the recording.
Thank you.
Thank you.